You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Madison woman turned her love of vinyl into the goal of becoming a DJ, a polka DJ. We'll talk with her about her favorite types of polkas and her hopes for getting people on the dance floor in the coming year. Now, though, millions of dollars in emergency food funding will end next month if the state legislature can't act in time. When the Wisconsin Supreme Court overturned the mask mandate last month, it put millions of dollars in federal food share funding on the line. For a state to access the extra funding, it has to have an emergency declaration related to the pandemic in place. And without a public health order, Wisconsin doesn't qualify. We're talking about the extra food stamps funding Wisconsin has gotten during the pandemic and what might happen if the money stops coming in next month. And we're taking your calls, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about what's happening, how it works, and how it might affect Wisconsin? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We've got Molly Beck with us. She covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
The federal food aid that we're talking about in question, it's connected to the state having this public health order, and that recently included a mask mandate. The court struck it down. Explain for us the reasoning.
So the court struck down the emergency declaration from the governor after a lawsuit was filed arguing that the governor did not have the power to issue multiple emergency declarations about the same emergency, about the same coronavirus pandemic. And that's because there's a state law that says that the governor can issue these declarations for 60 days and then the legislature has to approve it to be extended. And so with that court decision, there is no emergency declaration on the coronavirus pandemic in Wisconsin right now, which is a requirement for this extra layer of funding for the state's food stamp program, which is called Food Share.
So when do lawmakers have to figure out what to do? Because there's about $50 million a month at stake here.
Right. So if lawmakers don't want the state to lose that extra money, if they don't want any kind of interruption in that funding coming to Wisconsin, they'll need to act before May. And I believe there's only one floor session scheduled in April, and that's next week. So it's unclear what will happen. I've asked, the Evers administration and legislative leaders, and the only answer I got back was from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who said that they would look at options later this month, but he wasn't sure or didn't provide details about what they would be looking at and the timeline. I also spoke to the Assembly Health Committee chairman, who said he expected the legislature would do something about this. So he didn't seem too concerned about it. But again, I haven't heard back from the other house in the Capitol.
In February, this conversation came up because Republican lawmakers passed a bill repealing the mask mandate. And in that process, this idea of the extra food share funding was a problem. And they found a way to preserve it then. And then the governor chose to keep the mask mandate in place instead of that. So help mm-hmm. us better understand this struggle between the governor's office and the legislature. I know we don't have that much time. I get that. But this keeps yeah. happening. And it's specifically over this emergency order and who gets authority and when they should use it.
That's right. And with that veto, there was a bill. It was AB1. It was a coronavirus relief package. It included from lawmakers a sort of fix to this issue that would have allowed the governor to issue emergency declarations mm-hmm. related just to get this funding. But he vetoed that bill because it included other provisions, including allowing lawmakers to have control over federal spending. And so the story of that is that fix was not on its own. And we'll see what happens, if lawmakers choose to act on this. We'll see if they do a standalone bill or if they include it in something else. But, it just right now I haven't heard anything from, the legislature affirmatively about what they'll do about it. And I haven't heard if there's another way that the Department of Health Services could find to, you know, get the funding in some other fashion.
But the state does need another emergency declaration related to the pandemic to restore this funding?
That's my understanding. There may be some sort of, you know, special request, you know, the state could make to the Biden administration, but I've asked that question and haven't received a response from DHS, so it's possible there's not another option. But the only option that we know of right now is that the legislature could come in and pass something.
All right. We'll keep following this developing story. Molly, thanks for explaining the latest.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel helping us understand what's in the news. Now let's talk about what's at stake if Wisconsin doesn't comply with and have a new public health order. We've got Sherry Tussler, who's the executive director of Hunger Task Force. That's a food bank in Milwaukee. Sherry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here.
Help us understand how the state has benefited from about $50 million in more federal food share funding every month.
Ever since the emergency declaration went into place, along with the dual order at the federal level, anywhere between $50 and $60 million per month in additional federal funding has reached the debit cards of low-income households across the state of Wisconsin so that they could go to the grocery store and shop for food. About 708,000 people have been impacted in a positive way by this change. And so this declaration issue is significant and important to hungry people here in Wisconsin, but also to farmers and the dairy industry, the grocery industry, and the transportation industry that all benefit when we spend more federal money in our state.
The funding that was passed in that response act, it gives people 15% more than they would otherwise receive. That's through June of this year. How significant is that 15%?
It is significant in that it's $13.4 million a month in a broader sense, but it's significant because it elevates a single adult, for example, who pre-pandemic living in subsidized housing was getting $16 a month in food share. With the emergency declaration and the maximum allowable benefit, they went up to $200 per month. And now with that 15% bump are at $234 a month, meaning that a single could probably make it through the month on that $234 without having to visit an emergency food pantry.
Help us understand what your organization does and how you see this then.
We are an anti-hunger public policy expert and leader. So we operate a food bank here in Milwaukee County, but we also organize the Hunger Relief Federation of Wisconsin, which is 123 distinct organizations working to end hunger. We feed people today, but we also advocate for sound social policy. And this food share program it's taken a pandemic, literally, to create a positive aspect around it where people believe that other people need help and the unemployed need help. I would say as little as 5 years ago, we were talking about drug testing the poor. We were talking about work requirements. Now we're saying, oh my God, my friend, my neighbor, my family member needs food share because they lost their job due to the pandemic. And so it's become an important social program. It was always there, but now it's been elevated in terms of its esteem.
We're talking with Sherry Tussler, who's the executive director of Hunger Task Force. She just explained what that does, including being a food bank in Milwaukee. And we want to hear from you. The lines are open at 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic affected you financially? Will you continue to have an extra financial burden even as life starts going back to normal? What do you think lawmakers should do at this point? Who are the helpers in your life? 800-642-1234 is the number to call as we talk about increased aid for food and what's at stake if Wisconsin could lose it. 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening to Central Time. Wisconsin risks losing millions of dollars a month now that the state Supreme Court struck down the governor's emergency order related to the pandemic. That one included a mask mandate. Hunger Task Force Executive Director Sherry Tussler is our guest here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and we're talking about what the potential loss of millions in food aid next month could have, how it could affect people in Wisconsin. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Sherry, have you seen a change in need during this pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. Last year, the second week of March, everything closed, obviously, except for essential services, including the food bank and its related food pantries. We saw a dramatic increase in demand, nearly 50% in the first month of the pandemic. It leveled out over time and things got a little bit more even just about the time we got additional assistance from the federal government. But we were struggling there in the months of April and May. It was pretty tough.
Has this extra federal funding met the need? Is it the right amount?
I would say it's the most funding that the food share program has ever received. Other programs, including the commodity programs, where we get federal foods and give them to food pantries, were increased dramatically as well. And then the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children's Program, has seen an increase. And so what we're seeing is an emphasis now on getting food aid to people. And it's been, as I said earlier, a huge benefit to Wisconsin's food producers and farmers who are also in dramatic need during these times. Mm.
If Wisconsin doesn't receive that food share funding in May, what kind of choices does that put in front of people who rely on the program?
Well, one thing I want to clarify is that the federal government has notified the states that as these emergency orders begin to lapse across the country in response to an improved situation with the pandemic, that there will be a month of step-down benefits. Mm. And so the real issue will not be May, but June. And so people should feel real assured that if they're getting their food share benefits right now, that increased emergency payment will come in April. It will also come in May, but it will end in June. And so our legislature needs to take action, or our governor could take action, or our state's Department of Health secretary could also take action. And so in the state of Michigan, their health department actually made the declaration eliminating all of the drama related to the politics between the parties.
We are talking with Sherry Tussler, who's executive director of Hunger Task Force, and we are discussing food aid in Wisconsin at this time during the pandemic, especially as we don't quite know the future of extra funding that was helping people through the coronavirus pandemic. And we're taking your calls. We've got Judy in Appleton ready to join us. Welcome, Judy.
Hello, I am calling about the food stamps, and I'm happy that it's there. I use it. However, I see many people misuse it, and they should revamp the system a bit so that you don't get all the snacks and all the pop and all the stuff. I see people send their kids to the Quick Trip, and the kids got five friends, and they take the card and they go in there and they buy pop and they buy all the candy and all the stuff. And it's like, come on, that's not what this program is for.
Yeah. Judy, how do you use your benefits? How do you kind of maintain a thrifty responsibility then?
I cook at home. I don't buy prepackaged meals. I buy what is necessary to be able to make it stretch out, and I do just fine.
Judy, thank you so much for being willing to share your experience taking part in this program. And I think Judy probably struggles with things we've heard other people bring up here, you know, trying to act responsibly with what you have and also, you know, make the best decisions. And those are different for everyone, Sherry.
They absolutely are. And what I can say with regard to Judy's comment is that food is defined by the grocery industry and not by the USDA and its program. And so if it's got a UPC code on it that says it's food, it becomes food and eligible for purchase by the food stamp program. Everyone in the household is able to use that debit card, including children, to do shopping. And so those are the program rules that the federal government can't change, but are more influenced by the grocery industry.
And those benefits are accepted at a lot of places. You know, we've heard people in the past say, well, gas stations shouldn't take them or things. Sometimes gas stations are the primary source of food for a community where they don't have a grocery store. That's true in Wisconsin.
Yes, I live in urban Milwaukee where that is definitely true in my neighborhood. The gas station is going to have to carry what they call the depth of shelf. And so the federal government will allow them to accept EBT if they have a dozen or more of the specific items on hand that are defined as food.
Mo in Oconto is also ready to talk with us during this conversation. Hey, Mo.
Hey. I'm all for the food stamp program. If people qualify for it and they need food, we should feed them if we can. But the other thing that really upsets me is that these people in Madison, when they got rid of the mask mandate, and they were been working on this for months now, that really affects their economy. Like the woman, your guest said, it affects the farmers, it affects the grocery stores, it affects the workers that work in these industries, and it does have an effect on our economy, over $600 million that we're not going to get. And I think people should call their congressmen and senators and let them know, especially if they're the ones that are on the side that voted to get rid of this mandate without thinking it through.
Yeah, Mo, thanks for that comment. And Sherry, this is really just Mo emphasizing what you were talking about when it's not just about individual families, although we do want people to be able to be fed. It's also about our interconnected economy.
It absolutely is. Our food system is so dependent on the purchases that individuals make. Right at the beginning of the pandemic, we heard stories about dairy farmers spilling their milk because restaurants and schools had closed. And so there was no outlet for that milk, and it made sense for hungry people to get access to it. So our organization partnered with the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection here in Wisconsin and identified farmers and cheese cooperatives and other groups that were in need of a rescue. And we applied CARES Act funding to purchase those foods and distribute them to qualified food pantries across the state as a problem-solving mechanism. But we learned a lot about the pain of the dairy farmers and the other farmers, pork and beef, that were really struggling throughout the pandemic because of those closures.
Let's go ahead and welcome then Bernard in Racine. Bernard, what are you thinking about as we have this conversation about food help?
Well, I'd first like to commend you on your effort. I think it's a very, very valuable, worthwhile initiative that you're trying to make happen. Unfortunately, I'm not really one that's going wanting for food. I think my question is, what is being done to, look at the micro level or the macro level, ways to feed people efficiently, instead of food pantries or food stamps? I mean, are there anything that's exciting? I mean, is it because technology doesn't see that there's money in this initiative, that there is no effort on that side of it? Because if that's the case, I think that's sad.
Bernard, let me jump in here and get Sherry to answer your question, which is, beyond food pantries, are there innovative ways right now where we're trying to feed people?
It's a darn fine question. The federal nutrition assistance programs are in place to feed people immediately through emergency food pantries and commodity programs. and we balance saving agricultural excess by feeding it to the poor. We also have the school meals programs where those commodities go. The food stamp program actually is a big economic driver and probably the most effective way to get food to people, because they can shop at the grocery store and buy the foods that they like and that are healthful for them and respect their diet, their religion, and their culture. The idea of handing out food and saying as a charity, we've solved hunger, is that's wrong-minded. We can end hunger by making sure that food is purchased locally, and that food stamp program is one of the most effective ways to do that. We do have some effective things, like farmers markets are very effective. We have mobile markets that go to neighborhoods where stores are altogether absent. And so there are some fun things. If people want to check out our website, they can look and see what we've been doing to end hunger and not just feed people today.
Millions of Americans have relied on government aid over the past year to survive. How has this pandemic changed our understanding of social programs in this country?
I think it's been a big eye-opener for a lot of people, because just before the pandemic, we were talking about having able-bodied adults work for their food share or not receive it after 90 days. We wanted parents of school-aged children to work and prove that they were working in order to get food benefits. We wanted to drug test people. And so now all of a sudden, because we know somebody who needed food share, we're going, this is a good program. It's an important program. People should be able to have access to healthy food, and it should be affordable, and it should be, you know, positive for everybody. And so I think we shined a new light on food share and its importance in our economy, as well as to make sure that our neighbors, friends, and family members are all healthy.
So more people have needed assistance. So we realize that good people need assistance. So we realize that people need assistance.
Absolutely.
How do you think people, this pandemic will continue to affect people financially when it comes to food, even as we get vaccinated and are, you know, in the home stretch?
Well, you know, everybody's got to recover, and that economic recovery needs to, you know, include a living wage for people if they're really going to not be eligible for food share into the future. But people who are on food share should know that they'll be reviewed every 6 months. Listeners who are saying maybe this isn't such a great program should know that that review requires proof. And so we have to just, I guess, wait and see how it all goes and hope that the federal aid, as well as the attention towards the need, remains well after the pandemic.
Sherry, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Sherry Tussler is the executive director of Hunger Task Force. We talked about what could happen to people in need of help in Wisconsin now that the state risks losing millions of dollars a month in extra food aid from the federal government. That's tied to having a pandemic emergency order in place, and the state Supreme Court struck down the one issued by the governor. Coming up, an aspiring polka DJ talks about her love of the state's musical heritage and sharing it with a new generation of Wisconsinites. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Still to come on the Ideas Network, 1A's series The Sounds of America spotlights one of the world's greatest button accordion players, San Antonio's Flaco Jimenez. His work has been picked up by the Library of Congress to enter its Audio Hall of Fame. Meet him and some of his famous friends today on 1A Plus. That is at 6 o'clock. Now, a lot of people have opted to try out a new hobby over the last year. You might have taken up gardening for the first time, or learned how to bake sourdough bread, or maybe you became a polka DJ. Okay, maybe that last one is not quite so common, but it is exactly what our next guest did. Her love of music and Wisconsin culture turned into a hunt for the state's best polka records. Eventually, she's hoping to share her collection with a new generation, and most importantly, get people dancing. Stacey Harbaugh is a writer at Unstuck Communications and a volunteer at WORT Radio in Madison, and she talked earlier with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter.
Let's start with the DJ side of things. What made you decide to get some turntables and try this out?
Well, I've always loved vinyl music. I mean, I've been collecting records since maybe college. And I've always thought about becoming a DJ, but, you know, it seemed really kind of intimidating and, you know, I didn't really know if it was for me, but I've been involved with WORT FM for many years. And I made a 2020 New Year's resolution to learn how to do a music show at the community radio station, to learn how to like push the buttons and be able to be a sub for some of the music hosts there. And so I did get a couple of trainings and that kind of thing, but the COVID crisis kind of put a damper on that goal. So then it really shifted to how can I buy some turntables and practice at home? It really was, you know, a safer at home hobby.
And then how did you settle on polka as your genre?
It's been a road. I mean, I started to explore using digital, you know, a digital mixer, and I ripped all of my CDs. I really love reggae music, and so it started with that. But I was still craving that vinyl. I still wanted to find my little niche, you know. And I was thinking, you know, what could I do that maybe no one else is doing, or there are very few people doing? And I've always loved polka. You know, I've always loved going to festivals and hearing polka music in places in Wisconsin. And I just thought maybe that's something that I could do that would be unique and fun. And so I just started collecting, and it's just sort of taken off.
Stacy, I have one vinyl record one polka record on vinyl. I'm looking at it right now. It is No Beer in Heaven, Polkas and Waltzes by the Whoopi John Orchestra. You have a few more than that. Can you tell us a bit about your collection and some of your favorite stuff in there?
You bet. I've got maybe over like 100 polka records right now, and I just got started. There's so much more that I want to find, but I'm pretty sure I have that one that you have. And
oh, nice.
I really love focusing my collection on recordings that were made in Wisconsin. Kuka Records from Sauk City. I'm trying to collect all that I can from that. KL Records. There's, you know, some other smaller record labels that are from Wisconsin, others from New Ulm, Minnesota, the Pleasant Peasant Records I love to collect. And so I try to just focus on collecting mostly Dutchman style polka. It's a very, you know, folksy kind of sound. It's that like alpine kind of sound. And it sounds like another time. It's got this very vintage retro kind of sound, and I'm trying to stay to just focus my collection on those for now. There's so much to enjoy, but Wisconsin recordings are really special to me.
And I think we have a clip from someone who I believe is from South Central Wisconsin. I want to take a listen to Roger Bright and his band playing Pusky's Polka. Roger Bright and his band there. Stacy, I know you've listened to a lot of records over the last year. What do you think makes for a really good polka record? One that kind of stands out above the rest?
Where do I start? So first of all, I love polka bands that are smaller rather than bigger. If it's got, you know, a tuba, a drum kit, a squeeze box, maybe a banjo that could set up, you know, an acoustic stage at the corner of a bar, I know I'm going to love it. So one thing that I do is when I look at records, is it recorded in Wisconsin? You know, does it have a very long band list or a very short one? The shorter the band list, the more I'm probably going to like it. And I heard a little banjo, I think, in that last song and that squeezed by me. Roger Bright from Nuclearis, you know, he was such a great musician, and I'd love to collect more of his recordings as well. You know, and I just love the kitsch of some of these vintage polka recordings as well. I mean, if you've got a group of guys in what look like bowling jackets in front of a Winnebago, you're like, you know, that's going to be a good record. So, so I love finding those as well, and you know, kind of tracking that style.
We're talking with Stacy Harbaugh right now, writer at Unstuck Communications. She spent a part of the last year working on becoming the state's newest polka DJ, and Stacy, polka can feel like a kind of a generational music. I mean, for young people, there might be a sense of irony when listening to it. But for older Wisconsinites, this was the music that was playing at their first dates, at their weddings, at funerals even. Do you think spinning some polkas can kind of be a point of connection between the generations?
I really deeply hope so. And if I can help bridge that generational gap by bringing my turntables and these records to a neighborhood bar, the little hipster bars, any of the younger folks who really embrace that Wisconsin culture, if you like beer and brats and being together in, you know, a beer garden again, hopefully someday soon, I'm hoping to be able to inspire people to continue to love this Wisconsin sound. You know, I didn't grow up with polka music per se. I didn't grow up with, you know, polka music players in my family. I'm envious of those who do. But it is such a connection to the sound of the state. So I am hoping that younger people who love vinyl, who love music, and who love everything about Wisconsin, you know, they're really my target audience. And I hope we can gather together again soon.
A lot of people have tried new hobbies during the pandemic, and it can feel a little intimidating or clumsy at first. Did you encounter any of that when you first started trying to DJ?
For sure. At first I was very intimidated by the gear. You know, I'm not a musicologist. I don't know everything about polka music. I don't know everything about the history and like all of the artists. But I think it was really the COVID crisis and staying home that gave me that excuse to be able to try something new. I didn't have the immediate pressure of people wanting me to come and play for them. So really, I just had all of this space to practice and try new things and learn from tutorials on the internet and really try to get used to the gear on my own terms and on my own schedule. And so it has just been this wonderful exercise and overcoming imposter syndrome, you know, that little voice in your head that says, you're not good enough. Who do you think you are? You're 44 years old and you want to be a DJ? Come on. But it's not been that at all. I've had this very clear vision of what it is that I want to do. And I'm really looking forward to saying yes to all the opportunities that put me on a path to that vision of bringing fun, good time polka music to a new generation of listeners. So it's been a great way to learn.
As you mentioned, public events are starting to look like more of a safe possibility in the not too distant future. What are your plans for when we get to that point?
Well, I am hoping to, you know, like I said, be able to play polka at a neighborhood bar. If there's breweries that are launching, you know, a new German lager product, I'd love to play those events. But polka fests and, you know, all of those places where we can gather for, you know, Oktoberfest style celebrations, or even just to play polka music in the commercial breaks during a Packer game at the neighborhood bar. I think that would be a lot of fun. And for anybody else who really loves that sound and really loves that culture, I'm looking forward to connecting and seeing what's possible.
And getting to take that thing that you've been working on by yourself at home and then sharing it with a bunch of people in person, especially when it involves that good time vibe that polka has, I bet that's going to be pretty special.
I think it will be special. I'm a little nervous because I have been just enjoying this music just by myself and following my bliss on what sounds really good to me. But I think if it sounds good to me, other people will appreciate it too. So I'm looking forward to sharing that.
Well, Stacey, hopefully we will see you from the dance floor sometime soon. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. This is a great topic.
Stacey Harbaugh is a writer at Unstuck Communications. She's also a polka DJ. Stacey talked with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter about her journey to become Wisconsin's newest polka DJ. More Central Time is ahead. Thanks for joining us today. You're here with us on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. A digital GIF of Nyan Cat recently sold online for $590,000, a digital GIF. And a collage by the digital artist Beeple sold for $60 million. So each of these was a non-fungible token, or an NFT. What are they exactly? Here's Saturday Night Live attempting to explain it in song.
Hey, here's the thing about NFTs. It's a non-fungible token, you see. Non-fungible means that it's unique. There can only be one like you and me. NFTs
cryptocurrencies are insane. Built on a blockchain.
That's right.
A digital ledger of transactions. It records information on what's happening. When it's minted, you can sell it as art. And this concludes my rapping part.
So in case you didn't catch all of that, we brought in an expert. Steve Knoll is a digital and social media marketing professor at Madison Area Technical College. He's also an expert in cryptocurrencies. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
What does an NFT typically look like?
Well, it's digital, so it technically doesn't look like anything. The easiest way to really understand that is, imagine kind of like your social security number. You know, everybody has their own unique number assigned to them that can be used to kind of track your financial history. So an NFT is basically a piece of data that identifies a certain digital asset that who owns it, or if you transfer ownership, ultimately you're selling the NFT to somebody else. So it's like a copyright.
Okay, so we can't fully describe them because they're all unique. Mm-hmm. Can anyone make them?
Yes. They're part of what's called the blockchain. You've probably heard about Bitcoin in the last few years. And Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency that is basically recorded on what is called the blockchain. The blockchain, the easiest way to explain this is imagine millions and millions of computers all over the world running a specific ledger program. So think about like an accounting ledger. But instead of that ledger only existing at one place, the exact ledger is on millions of computers. So if you change it on one computer, it changes on all the computers. That's the blockchain, and that's the basis of how Bitcoin exists as a currency in the blockchain. So these new things, these NFTs, are basically a way to record ownership of a digital asset like a picture on the blockchain. So that way nobody can copy it, nobody can counterfeit or bootleg it. You know, it's not like art where if I make a painting and then I sell you the painting for $1 million, and then you take that painting and make a copy of it and sell that copy to somebody else, then they have a forgery. Well, if there had been like an NFT attached to my original painting, the person who bought the forgery would have known it was a forgery.
Hmm. We are talking with Steve Knoll, and we're talking about non-fungible tokens, breaking down what they are and how people use them or acquire them. We're open to your questions at 800-642-1234. What are you wondering about cryptocurrency? Maybe you make digital art or you're familiar with NFTs. Help us understand how you are at 800-642-1234. Steve, this is really catching on because we're seeing some of these sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. What's driving the price up?
Yeah, isn't that crazy? I think it's two things. Number one, with the price of Bitcoin just absolutely skyrocketing, a lot of investors are kind of saying, oh, I completely missed the boat in getting in on Bitcoin early. So I think a lot of people who have been following Bitcoin and how it's becoming more and more established and therefore more safe to purchase, they're kind of looking for the next concept, the next Bitcoin that they can maybe get in on the ground floor. So I think we're seeing a lot of that. I think we're seeing a lot of Bitcoin customers that really want to kind of get in on the action at the ground floor. You know, the other thing is just with the rise of social media, many, many artists have talked about how they don't want to publish any of their stuff on the internet because it's so easy just to download pictures and steal stuff. And, you know, this gives somebody, especially like a graphic artist or a photographer, you know, a way to tag their work and establish ownership. And then nobody else can claim that they own it. It's a way of digitally copywriting art.
So what's the goal then of acquiring the NFT? What can you do with it?
Well, it's really like a certificate of ownership.
Yeah.
So the artwork is still out there, and people certainly can pass that around and share it. But at the end of the day, you own it. And I think that that's, you know, the other group of people who are interested in this are people who buy art as an investment, traditional art. Now, we're not talking about people that, you know, buy a painting because it looks good next to the couch. It's the people that buy a painting hoping that it's going to go up in value. So, you know, they're out there trying to find, you know, the next Picasso or the next Rembrandt or whatever famous artist, and then buying up their work before it skyrockets in value. So I think a lot of professional art collectors, you know, not people who are just buying stuff for decoration, but people buying art as an investment, are looking at NFTs and saying, wow, look what happened with Bitcoin. Is this the next Bitcoin? But it's all about the art world. And there's a lot of money out there. There's a lot of wealthy people that acquire art. And I think this is kind of, you know, a bit of a trendy concept. I honestly don't know if it's a good deal right now. This could be, you know, just something that's new and trendy, and whether or not it's going to sustain long time, that's hard to say. You know, with things like Bitcoin, we're seeing evidence that it's not going away. It's stabilizing, and it's probably going to be a regular currency in the future. But NFTs, you know, unless I'm the artist, I don't know if I'd be willing to pay a lot of money for it.
We are talking about NFTs, which are non-fungible tokens, and we're understanding what they are, how they work, and what the future might hold here. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're welcoming your calls, and we've got Jim from Dubuque, Iowa on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hi. You're asking why the price of these are going up, and I think it comes down to a little more than speculation. Same thing with Bitcoin. There's so much money sloshing around. Most people don't realize that something close to 40% of all dollars ever created in history were created in the last year. And I think it's speculation rather than investment.
Okay, Jim, thanks for that. And, you know, Jim saying, hey, inflation has a role here. Do you think is that what you're seeing, Steve?
Well, it's definitely part of it. I think in terms of, like, you know, any type of investment, you know, you look at speculation. The whole idea is you always buy low, sell high. That's the basic idea of any type of investment. And I think that that's what people are really attracted to with these NFTs, especially, you know, there have been this handful of high-profile million-dollar sales. But there's also the reality that probably 99% of NFTs are worth about $5. So, you know, that's the thing, is as much as it's, like, really amazing when you hear on the news about millions of dollars, you know, for something like this, it's no different than how many, you know, painters, you know, are alive in the country painting. How many of them are actually able to sell their work, and how many of them make a living on it? How many of them become rich from being a painter? You know, it's probably 0.1% or even less. So it is all speculation. It's the idea that you just want to meet the next, you know, Andy Warhol before they become famous, and then buy a bunch of work. And then once they're rich and famous, you can sell it all and become rich yourself. It's no different than stocks, really. You always look for that new hot company.
And I'm just thinking about the flip side here with someone who owns the NFT, you know, has that ability to say, this is mine. It feels a little bit counterintuitive to this digital age, even though it's digital, because so much of the digital revolution has been that we can share things so readily and easily and duplicate things without needing more resources. And this is kind of like a little bit of pushback. It creates a little bit of scarcity.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of why we're seeing this technology on the rise is, you know, there is this belief that if it's on the internet, it's free to use. And that is not true. You can't just find a photo, download it, and use it, you know, in an ad or a commercial or anything like that. You know, you have to pay a copyright for that. And a lot of everything from musicians to art, really any type of artist, you know, the internet has been a mixed blessing. In one way, it's a good tool to get exposure and have people get introduced to your art. But at the same point, too, it's a lot harder to make money because there certainly is a lot of, you know, piracy and other just, you know, innocent, like, oh, I didn't know that, we couldn't use that for free attitude. So I think that the, you know, the art world especially is embracing something like this. You know, to me, this seems to be where NFTs are going. It's not necessarily, you know, this is a thing for people to get rich on. It's really probably going to become more of a regular part of digital content and just a way to kind of, you know, protect the original content creator, you know, protect that photographer, protect that artist, you know, and say that, you know, this is my work. And if you want to use it, you've got to pay me for my work. And I think overall, that's a good thing. But, you know, the whole idea of is it the next, you know, gold rush? I think the jury might be out on that one.
All right. Well, we'll have to check back in with you if that happens. Steve, thank you for joining us today.
Cool. Thank you as always. Take care.
Steve Noel is a digital and social media marketing professor at Madison Area Technical College, and he joined us to break down non-fungible tokens or NFTs.